Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Lori Fatchett McGee, and it is my privilege to serve as worship leader for today's service. I am joined today by Worship Associate Elaine Bowen, Interim Director of Religious Education Karen Labracco, and Music Director Hal Walker, and special musical guest Judy Wimmer. We are delighted to welcome you to this religious community. We light our chalice this morning in gratitude for all the ways that we find art in our lives. Nature's art, human's art, it is all one. It is all a spark of the divine.
This verse I'm writing from my heart gives voice to something that's in my soul. Its vision lights the way for my poem to change the world. I'm just a child, but my poem is strong and proud. My pen writes wild, and then the words come out my mouth. My whole life sings, the poetry is my home. My soul writes things that my mind never would have known. This verse I'm writing from my heart gives voice to something that's in my soul. Its vision lights the way for my poem to change the world. My poem will change the world.
Our call to worship, our invitation to you into this time of sacred space, is a poem by a young American poet named Samantha Reynolds. This is where creativity hides. Hollow out your memories until you get to the dustiest bits jammed into the corners of your spirit. Forgotten weekends, beliefs you thought were glued on tight, the way shame ignites, only dormant, never gone. How does it all fit? The wake of a life. So much history spooled inside us. You wonder what the point is in all this remembering. But a tree does more than reach for the sun. It feasts on the rain, sucking it like a straw from its darkest buried roots. This is where creativity hides. Wearing the mask of your old stories, words and images, the debris of time waiting to be stitched into art.
Deja vu, that feeling, that sense that I've been here before, I've done this before. I got that feeling. It was started out as a kind of a usual drive. It was Monday in January, Martin Luther King Day, and I was making my usual drive back home in upstate New York from Kent, Ohio, from you. A usual winter drive until, or maybe then it was when the snow started. The snow started a little at a time, but by the time I got to Erie, Pennsylvania, on I-90, it was really snowing. It got so I couldn't see very much. My the windshield wipers iced over. There was this little window of visibility, and that was it. But up ahead, I saw the sign for the exit. Great, I am getting off here because I'm not sure. I can't even see the lines on the road. There wasn't even the ruts to follow. Darn it, I missed it. How could I miss that exit again? Just like in 1983. But there was another one. I made it 4 miles down, very slow, treacherous miles down. And there I saw the glow of those golden arches and the Red Roof Inn sign. I made it. This time I made it on that exit ramp. Made my way over to those golden arches. And inside that cozy, warm McDonald's, while there was a blizzard all around us, I struck up a conversation with another stranded traveler. This woman was on her way from visiting her parents in Rochester, New York, very near where I live. She was on her way back to Kent, Ohio. What an amazing thing. And over coffee and warm soup, we had some conversations. I told her about how in 1983, I was making this same trip. I missed that same exit because I couldn't see because the snow was so bad. And that time, in the car with me was my husband and my not quite 4-month-old baby. We were on our way to show off this baby to all the family in Buffalo. And I missed that exit, and I ended up having my Christmas Eve dinner in that same McDonald's. And we got to talking about the kind of work that we did. And this woman, when I told her I worked for the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent, Ohio, her face lit up. She knew about us. She knew about our people and our values. She had attended here in the past, and her now adult son had attended religious education programs in this church. No longer was she sitting in our pews, but a part of this church was always with her and with her son. Now, it's as we get near the end of our stewardship campaign, I ask you to think about not only what I get from this church and this community, but consider how your gift of your time, your talent, and your treasure enriches not only those of us that are here right now and the folks that are sitting next to you on the pew, but this whole Kent, Ohio community, everybody in Erie, Pennsylvania, and really the whole world. You do make a difference. You are that light, that gift to our souls. So thank you.
As we enter into a time of silent reflection this morning, I offer these words for you to consider. This is from John O'Donohue. The heart of human identity is the capacity and desire for birthing. To be is to become creative and bring forth the beautiful. And will you now join me in the spirit of prayer or meditation as is your practice? Mother Spirit, Father Spirit, we gathered this morning in this room, coming from many rooms. Rooms that hold many emotions, sorrow and joy, anger and happiness, compassion and distress. We have gathered in this room to find that which is beyond ourselves, to worship, to pray, to sing, to find the joy. We all have the spark of the divine within us, a spark that leads us to want to create, whatever that creation may be. Art takes many forms, but they are all one. Let us give our creation, our spark of the divine, out into the world. Let us allow it to bring us together. Amen, and blessed be.
To understand how I experience spirituality and art, first, I need to define spirituality and creativity. So what does spirituality mean? First, it means different things to different people. For some, it is a heightened awareness experienced in a group, but for others, it is experienced alone, often in nature. It is almost always a singular experience with me. For my spirituality to manifest itself best, I need to just see or experience directly my surrounding without labeling objects or commenting with my inner voice. Instead of saying to myself, "Look at that bicycle. What kind is it?" I need not to say or think anything. As soon as I define or comment on something, I put a barrier between myself and the object. By naming it bicycle, my definition of bicycle is imposed upon it. It can no longer become a shimmering web of iridescent color. It's just bicycle. The barrier I erect prevents the world from seeping into my consciousness in a deep, subtle way. Or, as we all have heard, being at one with the universe. Creativity. The basic definition of creativity is bringing something new into being. Notice that spirituality is not required to be creative. I can carve a piece of wood into a new shape or arrange a song to give it a different feel, but I don't have to be in a spiritual state to do so. In fact, I don't think I can be equally spiritual and creative at the same time. Creativity can be relaxing, my mind can wander and daydream, but I am rarely spiritual while creating. Let me tell you a short story to explain how this process works for me. And this just happened a month ago. I made a birthday card for my brother. The cover read, "Happy Birthday, Gary," with the word Gary spelled out using a photo of a found object for each letter. You know the things where you've seen calendars and alphabets made of twigs. Well, I wanted to do my own. As I started walking around downtown Kent looking for things to photograph, I found the letter Y quickly, but the other letters were slow in appearing. I realized that the letters may not show up looking like a letter, but may be buried in a jumble of other shapes. I also realized that they may appear at any angle, not just right side up. I was looking for letters that may not look like letters at all. This forced me to widen my perspective and become more aware of my surroundings, whether it be the whole side of a building or a collection of twigs blown into a tiny corner of a doorway. I had to look more deeply for the shapes I needed, and that quieted my mind. I slowly entered into my spiritual space. Sounds fell into the background. I noticed traffic and people less. I saw letters in shapes. As soon as I grabbed my camera to get a shot, I shifted into creative mode, relegating my spirituality to a background running process. Where's the best light? Can I find a background that will bring out the letter? How should I set the exposure? I did not leave the spiritual state, but I shared it with my creativity. But once the photo was taken, I shifted back into full spiritual mode. I walked up the west side of Franklin, then down the east side. I talked to people, but they seemed somewhat remote. Then I found the most elusive letter, a G, in front of scribbles on the rusty steel tree sculpture. You probably recognize that, that sculpture. It was backwards, but I could fix that. And I turned it around, and there's the letter G. I probably would not have noticed that it was that if my awareness was not at a heightened level, at one with the sculpture. With my mission accomplished, I knew I was returning to reality as I asked myself, where did I park my car? My spiritual space is kind of a curious thing. I'm unaware that I'm entering into it, and it's always a slow entry, and I can't force it. It's a subtle letting go of my everyday world, and it's only when I come out of it that I realize that I was actually in it at all, much like falling asleep. Afterwards, I often tell Christy, ah, the magic was happening again.
When I was preparing for this reflection, I told my daughter that I was going to be writing something about my art, and she said, what kind of art do you do? So I explained to her that sewing is an art form, and her reply was, it's not that special. Now, I understand where she was coming from, really. Everybody wears clothes, they wear underwear, they buy bags, they buy purses. They're usually pretty cheap, and most people don't even really think about where they came from or how they were constructed. Now that I sew, I have a new motto, though. Why buy it for $20 when you can make it yourself for $92 worth of supplies? I've dabbled in a lot of crafts over the years, like refinishing furniture, jewelry making, and scrapbooking, but I come from a family of sewists. My grandmother was an amazing seamstress. She made clothes for her children, her grandchildren, and for herself, and I've been told that she wanted to be a fashion designer at one time, though that didn't come to fruition. I have fond memories of my own mother sewing at the kitchen table when I was a little girl. My job was to pick up the pins on the floor, and I thought that was great. I don't know why now, because it's a pain. And of course, I took home ec in high school, and I made the requisite little pillow shaped like a shark. When I became a teenager early in college, I did a couple projects with my grandmother. She taught me a few more things, and I really quickly learned that this was not a way to save money. So as a poor college student, I sort of let sewing go and didn't really come back to it for quite some time. About 20 or so years later, after I learned how to sew, it became more than a useful skill to me. While I was writing this reflection, I came up with a whole entire list of things, and I've managed to sort of narrow it down into three for you. First, for me, sewing is tradition. A couple years ago, my grandmother was in the late stages of dementia. I'd had her sewing machine for years, but I hadn't touched it. But she was on my mind, and the urge to sew hit me. I sewed a little, the machine jammed up, the thread broke, I fixed it. I sewed a little bit more, the machine jammed up, the thread broke, I fixed it. Repeat. And I muddled through a couple projects and got really frustrated. And I was sort of ready to give up at that point. It was not working for me. But then my grandmother passed away. And she and I were never close. We were, as it turns out, a lot the same. Both very introverted, and I find that I get along better with extroverts because they just talk, and I can listen, and that works well for me. But two introverts in the room, you know, not so much. But when she passed away, I got a little sentimental, and I just ran out and bought a brand new sewing machine and said, okay, I'm going to sew now. So I watched some videos on YouTube, I read some blogs, joined some groups on Facebook, and I learned a lot really quickly. So the first thing that sewing really gave me was this connection to my grandmother and a realization of how alike we were after she was gone. The second, for me, as Brad mentioned, sewing is a type of a meditation. It takes me into the moment. It clears my mind. When I'm sewing, I'm sorting through my hordes of fabric, looking for the right colors, the right textures for the project that I want to do. And then I cut it out, and the crunching sound of the scissors going through it, the sound of the machine whirring as I'm sewing up the seams and finishing my project. It's also an act of patience and creativity and tenacity to finish something. I feel accomplishment and joy when I pick something up and say, wow, that's perfect. That's just how I imagined it. And also an exercise in forgiveness when I pick something up and say, oh my gosh, what is that? That looks terrible. And of course, there's that little bit of ego when I finish a project and I can show somebody and say, hey, look, I made this dress. What do you think? And they say, wow, you made that. And, you know, it kind of builds me up a little. The final thing that I wanted to mention about sewing for me is community and giving back. I couldn't talk about sewing nowadays without mentioning the socially responsible sweatshop of Kent. Marianne Casper created this group. She invited me to be a part of it last year at SI when she learned that I knew how to sew. This group is now award-winning. We've won an award for recycling. And in short, we meet a couple times a month at Carol Gould's house, your third and final mention for the morning. We sew yoga bags, eye pillows, bolsters for yoga, market bags. And all of these items are sold at the farmers market in Kent and also at local yoga studios. The money that comes from this funds the Lettuce Loop program, which is a matching program for people that receive food assistance from the county on a SNAP card. If they scan their card and get $10 to spend at the market, we match them with another $10. So it doubles their fresh food budget and also gives back to the local farmers because there's even more money that would have been going to that is going to them. This really means a lot to me now. And the fact that I'm in this group and I've met a whole new group of amazing women, it can't be described. I want to add also that this sweatshop is socially responsible because they feed us, and we are fed on Spode China. So, in summary, for me, my art has given me a closeness to my grandmother, helps me quiet my mind in meditation, and also helps me make a difference in the community.
At Summer Institute in 2014, Mary Spicer offered an afternoon workshop called Fiber Action Network, which welcomed all levels of knitters and crocheters to come together. My daughter Megan and I decided to go. She knew how to knit. I thought I might learn a new skill. Either way, my then 12-year-old was willingly wanting to do something with her mom. So I probably would have agreed even if it was making mosaic with glitter. The class itself was rather frustrating. An experienced knitter there patiently tried to teach me to cast on, which is putting the first row of stitches on the needle, and I was completely unsuccessful. Then I ran into Carol Gould around dinner time. We did not plan this, by the way. If you don't know Carol from our congregation, you should introduce yourself. She's often downstairs selling grocery cards during our social hour and more often has a yarn project in her hands. So she took my practice yarn and needles and with magic dancing hands had done my cast on and then showed me the first stitch, how to knit. She said, do that for a while and then I'll show you how to purl. Needless to say, I was hooked. Pun intended. My daughter lost interest after that first day, what with all the other options available at SI, but not me. I practiced knitting during morning worship, during Rabbi Horowitz's morning talk, in the afternoon, in the dining hall, even in the dark in the pub. I bought 2 skeins of expensive wool at the yarn shop in Oberlin and saved them for when I was good enough to attempt a real project. 6 months later, here's what I made with that fancy yarn. Knitting for me is a meditative art. Simple, mindless knitting is calming and focusing for me. You will often see me knitting during worship service. Before, my mind would wander easily. What are we going to eat after service? Do I need to go grocery shopping? Oh, wait, I love this song. But knitting has actually allowed me to compartmentalize my obsessive inner voice that plans continually. I put her aside when I knit. If she's really loud, I pick a complicated pattern that focuses my concentration. Knitting teaches me patience. Mistakes will be made. You can always undo. Backing up in knitting is called tinking, T-I-N-K, which is knit spelled backwards. And if you really mess up, you can frog your work, which gets its name because you rip it, rip it, rip it. I once spent hours untangling a ball of yarn, and there's an entire service in that lesson. Knitting has definitely taught me how to quiet my mind and find peace. But knitting is also a very social art. People who would otherwise probably not have a reason to talk to me will come up to me and ask, "What are you making?" I've had great conversations at social events around the topic of knitting. There's an entire social media platform devoted to it. And if you're on Ravelry, I'm Dita48, just friend me. I call it socially acceptable multitasking. As an introvert, I'm not entirely comfortable in group settings, and I've learned I need to conserve my energy and spend it wisely in the group setting. And knitting provides a perfect buffer for this. I can recover my energy even in a crowded room full of people simply by focusing on the work in my lap. This was a surprising and rewarding discovery for me. And finally, I really enjoy how knitting connects me to other people in my life. I love knitting for other people, and while I'm working on that project, I hold them in my thoughts, and I feel especially close to them. A typical project takes me 1 to 2 months to complete, and I like to envision that I am imbuing the fiber with my love and positive intention for that person. I'll end with a quote from Stephanie Pearl McPhee. She's known as the Yarn Harlot. She's a well-known writer and blogger, and she wrote a book, At Knit's End, Meditations for Women Who Knit Too Much. She says this: "Sometimes people come up to me when I am knitting and say things like, 'Oh, I wish I could knit, but I'm just not the kind of person who can sit and waste time like that.' How can knitting be wasting time? First, I never just knit. I knit and think. I knit and listen. Knit and watch. Second, you aren't wasting time if you get a useful or beautiful object at the end of it."
I've never really considered myself a particularly creative person because I tend to adhere to rules a bit rigidly. I am not a risk taker, nor am I terribly adventuresome. When I cook, I follow recipes closely. When I sew, I follow the pattern to the letter. When I work counted cross stitch, it is exact, precise, from the pattern, no deviation. I've never colored outside the lines. I sing melody, not harmony, most of the time. I like to stay in my comfort zone where things are just so. When Lori asked me to offer a reflection, I had to give it some pause and a bit of thought. Where have I allowed creativity to enter my life? Where has it taken root, grown, and flourished? There was a small aha moment. Of course. American poet Hart Crane said it beautifully. "One must be drenched in words, literally soaking in them, to have the right ones form themselves in the proper pattern at the right moment." Words have been and continue to be an amazing creative force in my life. From an early age, I became a voracious reader. The world of books, with all those glorious words and beautiful places, softened the pain of a lonely childhood. Words became my friends, my comfort, my solace, and my salvation. The road from reader to writer was a natural path for me, paved in parts of speech, punctuated with commas and semicolons, and lined with adjectives. I began to write in earnest during those teen years of uncertainty, angst, and unrequited feelings. I have never stopped, for no matter my age, those feelings remain. There is a beauty in the flow of words from the mind and heart onto paper, a bit like tears rolling down one's face, cleansing, cathartic, comforting. Author Truman Capote said it well when he commented, "To me, the greatest pleasure of writing is not what it's about, but the inner music words make." The inner music words make. I call that spirit talk and soul speak. You may wish to call it something else. But what it means to have the ability to speak, to sing, to share that inner music with my voice into this beloved community is both gift and blessing. From my writer's soul, from my writer's heart, thank you.
If I had to give this reflection a title, it would be "The True Story of How Jewelry Making Saved My Life." Because in a very literal sense, it did just that. Of course, this can only really be seen in hindsight. I had no idea at the time that working with those beads and wires would lift me from the most serious depression I had ever experienced. When my first granddaughter, Ava, was born, my daughter, Leanne, was only 18 years old. Leanne still lived at home as Ava's father, Caleb, was an Army private stationed in Cuba for a year. Leanne did not yet drive and was very dependent on me for transportation to Ava's many, many doctor's appointments. Ava was born with a serious heart defect, and she required much care in those early days. My daughter, being so very young, was not quite up to the challenge of motherhood, especially considering the intense care Ava needed to stay healthy and to thrive. Now, don't get me wrong, Leanne tried. She did the best she could given her age and the trying circumstances of Ava's birth. Nevertheless, most of the mothering of Ava fell to me. For the first 16 months following her birth, I was her primary caregiver. Of course, my spouse Joe was there as well, but she was working at the time, and I had an entire summer off. Naturally, Ava and I bonded as mother and daughter. I didn't mean for this to happen. It just did. When the end of Caleb's deployment came around in June of 2010, he found out he would be stationed in Missouri for at least a year, and they began planning for the move west. I was utterly terrified. I knew that my time with Ava was coming to an end, and I didn't know how to handle it. Even now, I'm not sure how I made it through those last few weeks knowing she was leaving. I still recall how it felt when they drove away with her. I felt broken and so, so sad. Like a piece of me went with her. And in truth, it did. Our house, once filled with colorful toys and baby sounds, was now as quiet as a tomb. Empty is the best word to describe those days. Everything, including my soul, felt empty. I sank into a deep and pervasive depression. The only activities I left the house for were work and church. And to be sure, this community, my spouse, my family, my friends, sustained me. But there was only so much any outside source could do to heal my broken heart. After about 3 months, I became aware of my depression. I was so stuck in it that it was invisible to me. It suddenly occurred to me one day that I had stopped reading. Reading was such a huge part of my life from the time I was a child, and finding that I had completely lost enjoyment from it was my wake-up call. I knew then I had to do something to lift myself up, to find enjoyment in life again, or I would be lost. But what to do? It was then I discovered jewelry making. I had always been interested in this particular craft, and now, with all this free time on my hands, it seemed like the perfect time to begin. I got several books out of the library, watched some videos on YouTube, and got to work. I made necklaces, earrings, bracelets. I found bead stores in Medina and Oberlin, and of course, the wide world of the internet. My designs got more complex. I used cording, chains, elastic, beads of glass, crystal, wood, and metal. I made more jewelry than I could ever possibly wear. I spent hours upon hours in my newly appointed craft room with my pliers and wires and beads. And slowly, the fog lifted. Slowly, I came back to the surface. I began reading again, living life again. We visited Ava as much as time and distance would allow, and in between, I was okay. I had something to occupy my mind and my time. Making jewelry, the act of creating something beautiful, repaired my broken spirit. It opened me up to engaging in the fullness of life once again. And this experience of creativity as spiritual pathway, is certainly not unique to me, as we've heard this morning. In fact, there are myriad books, articles, and research on how creativity and spirituality converge. I want to lift up just one quote this morning from an article by Dr. Christine Paintner that really speaks to the heart of this idea. She says, "Here is another important place where the spiritual life and the creative life converge, in the profound need and longing to make space for and listen to the depths of experience that call me beyond myself in search of greater meaning in my life, into a relationship with mystery and toward a greater cultivation of spiritual practice." By intentionally making space in my life to create, I moved beyond my own suffering and found meaning in life once again. I leave you this morning with some questions to consider. In what ways do you tend to your own desire for creativity? Do you have a spiritual practice that contributes to the cultivation of meaning in your life? In what ways do you honor your own need for creative process? How will you be creative today? May it be so, and amen.
I've been asked to keep this brief, so briefly, 1 week left. We only have half our pledges in so far, and we have half the funding we need to support our desired budget. What that means, here's the kind of frightening part for you guys. What that means is that this last week, we will be contacting those who we have not heard from yet to help remind you that we really need to be in this together. So don't put yourself in a position of having to look behind you at the movie theater. Don't put yourself in the position of stepping up to the counter at the drugstore to buy your unmentionables. And please don't put yourself in the position of being in your yoga class doing the downward dog and noticing who's right behind you crouched down. Please save us some time. Get your pledges in. Don't procrastinate. We love you all. We're all in this together. Thank you.
A spirit beckons to my soul. It's in the wind, I hear it calling me. Come to me. Out on the path among the trees, I hear the rustle of leaves whispering. Come to me. It soothes my daily worries. It calms my troubled mind. It fills my heart with comfort and gently guides me home. A spirit beckons to my soul. It's in the wind, I hear it calling me. Come to me. The beauty of the path unfolds before my eyes. I feel it drawing me. Come to me. It gives me rest and solace from a world filled with pain. It helps me to find comfort, to start all over again. It brings me peace and wisdom. It shelters me from harm. It teaches me to listen and take some time to pause. Spirit beckons to my soul. It's in the wind, I hear it calling me, drawing me, whispering, come to me, come to me.
Gathered in witness to the proposition that beneath all of our diversity there lies a unity which binds us one to the other, to the earth and to the stars. We have gathered in witness. Let us take that witness out into the world. Go in peace. Bye.